and welcome to Total Football Debate, Pod 56. That is about as short as an introduction as you're going to get this week. We're not joined by Cookie, we're not joined by Cossie, and we're not joined by the ever normally reliable Scott, who earlier than expected, didn't wait for Fergie time on this one, eagerly anticipated the arrival of his baby boy Saturday night. So he is not with us, he's busy on daddy duty. I'm sure we'll have a lot of fun editing this whilst he's doing the nighttime wake-up calls. So it is just me tonight. We'll be running through all the weekend's action, which seems like a long time ago now, given that we are midweek, but this will hopefully be out to you as normal to review going into rolling into this weekend's fixtures. Again, we'll start with televised games, although, you know, because of a certain result, I fear that there'll be, a bit of repetition on a certain club that I think just loves media attention as a whole, and I think it's a mess, but we'll get on to that. And then, of course, we'll cover the rest of the games as well from the course of the weekend, and, of course, the game, the penultimate game, which was on Monday night. So, going to start at the beginning of the weekend, which, as I say, seems like a long time ago now. Villa-Everton was the opener on lunchtime. Quite a big game in some respects. Murmurs about Gerrard and the changing room not being a happy place. Obviously, Tyrone Mings, he was restored to the lineup this time round. Watkins also got his first start of the season. There started to be murmurs that he may well be one that could be on his way out as well. So interesting game from that respect. Switch over to Everton, much aligned to last season. You know, the pressure is on. They had the blow of Calvert-Lewin. They brought in Onana, midfielder, which on paper seems like a good signing, but they're still lacking in key areas, especially after the sale of Richarlison as well. So big game for them performance-wise to see what they came up with. Obviously, they more recently brought in Connor Cody, who went alongside Tarkowski as well. Talking points for me, massively, I think, was the restoration, if you like, of Ollie Watkins. I've always rated him. Couldn't quite understand why he, you know, seemingly from outside looking in, just kind of tailed off in terms of his presence at Villa when Gerrard came in and also beginning of the season. I wouldn't have him down as a disposable one, but seemingly Ings seemed to be the preferred option. Ironically, Scott mentioned last week he had quite a big bit to say on Danny Ings. He was quite influential in this game and scored an absolute blinder of a goal, which was a great finish. But yeah, Ollie Watkins done himself no harm in that game at all. Big result for Gerrard, because I think had this result been a draw or, you know, Everton, worst case, got the win, I think question marks would have been earmarked. I think, you know, there was murmurs about the changing room and so forth as well. So massive, massive result for Gerrard. Ironically, come up against my Palace at Selhurst at the weekend, which arguably Frost is probably not the best timed, but we'll get to that later on. As for Everton, I think that game is going to sum up their season this season, dependent, subject to whatever they do in the transfer market over the next couple of weeks. Over the last couple of days, they've been linked with Sarr from Watford and Garner Gaia from PSG, who obviously used to play for them as well. So jury's still out on them, but, you know, Calvert-Lewin being lost again is a big, big blow for Lampard as well. As I say, defensively, they're bolstered with Tarkowski and Connor Cody. I actually think they're probably the right kind of signings they need at the backup with Pickford in goal. That's probably not too, too bad, but they are in desperate need of, I'd say, reinforcements in attack before we can kind of judge anything other than what we've projected this season, which, of course, is a relegation struggle as well. As for Villa, say, decent performance, goal-scoring threat. Watkins looked like he was back, you know, got the swing of it again. And, you know, shout out for Buendia, who also was quite instrumental and got man of the match as well. And he's one that, especially last season, maybe didn't quite get the rub of the green in terms of the impact he was looking to make at the club initially. But seemingly seems to be finding his way. And let's say big result for Gerrard. Everton, though, two games gone, 0 points. So they'll be desperately, desperately looking to, I should think, reinforce that. Interesting as well, Anthony Gordon, Chelsea's interest there. £40 to £50 million bids being muted around. Can they afford to lose him, or will they take the money and run? Big couple of weeks ahead for them. Regardless of what you think of Gordon, he's obviously a key player for Everton Football Club. So that's not an easy situation for them to be in. And of course, that was the lunchtime kickoff. We roll on to then Saturday evening. And I can't say I'm surprised, to be honest. Brentford, Manchester United, 5:30 kickoff at Brentford. And it just got from bad to worse for Ten Hag and United. And not even that. I mean, to put in, well, I can't even say the level of performance they did, because I don't think that performance was even a level, to be honest. But to put in that performance after the result at Old Trafford against Brighton on your first game of the season, to put in a performance like that, especially in the first, you know, 45 minutes, that first half, it was an absolute disgrace. And I keep hearing people, and namely Man United supporters, blaming the Glazers, the ownership, which I kind of get to a point from an infrastructure perspective, because clearly since Ferguson left, the Glazers have not been able to get that internal infrastructure in terms of director of football and who's managing what behind the scenes. It's just not worked. It's been seemingly too commercial focused. New managers come in, high turnover of players, plenty of opportunity to kind of get business done early and back him. Seemingly they haven't. Obviously they've brought in two or three players, but not the kind of big hitters or game changers you were maybe expecting. The De Jong saga continues to drag on, and seemingly they seem to be losing that battle. As recently as now, as we're talking right now, there's all of a sudden been a splurge of scattergun names, whether or not that's the press and agents trying to sustain Man United further. But, you know, there was Corella, I think, from Atletico Madrid muted as a striker out of nowhere. Casemiro from Real Madrid. Then I've seen links this evening with potentially João Felix as well. So it's an absolute mess. And as I say, going back to the point about owners, as much as it is about owners, and partially this would lay down to the owners, but you could argue that actually this whole thing clearly comes down to recruitment and strategy. Because if the recruitment plan when Ten Hag was in was to back him based on Dutch League players, then clearly that Manchester United as a football club are only ever reactive in their recruitment. If the recruitment is that short-sighted, then that is a major, major problem for Manchester United Football Club, because that isn't going to change. The thing is, you look at the likes of Arsenal, Tottenham, Man City, Liverpool's, you know, even smaller clubs, Brighton, namely, being one of them, Crystal Palace, Brentford are a good, you know, example as well. All of these clubs have plans from top to bottom. So you've got a manager or a coach in that understands the philosophy and the style of play that needs to be played. You've got a director of football that goes out and a recruitment team that scouts those players day in, day out. And within those, there'll be a plan A, plan B and plan C. With Man United, seemingly, there doesn't seem to be a plan B or C, like with Frankie de Jong. And then all of a sudden, scattergun names like Casemiro are coming out. So massive problems at Man United. Again, we said the same last... I'm not going to give it too much airtime, because we said the same last week, and it's clear as day there are major problems there that, quite frankly, aren't going to change anytime soon. I think I said it last week, the conversation of them being top four or a big club needs to stop, because they're quite simply not. They haven't been at it for years. And Arsenal, if their early season form was anything to go by, and Spurs, are two teams that seemingly were behind Man United maybe last season and the season before, when the season started last season and the season before, and they've overtaken them. So, you know, I think you can comfortably take, you know, forget top four. This is, can they finish in top six or seven? Because I think they'll be struggling with that at the moment. Enough about United, though, because I do think it was a tragedy on their part. As much as it was a tragedy, Brentford, credit to them, they fully took advantage of it, got in their faces, pressed as a team, and made it a very, very uncomfortable afternoon for Man United. The only slight disappointment for me was that, you know, we didn't get 5, 6 or 7 embarrassing further in the second half, but brilliant play from Brentford, targeted them at set pieces, which we, you know, was discussed with Martinez. Could he handle the Premier League? De Gea, wow, just wow for that first goal, for that to happen. You just can't, you can't plan for that as a team, but, you know, if your team's not at it, then, you know, that's how it goes. Then, that, you know, it's absolutely pathetic, really. From a Brentford perspective, though, I am going to say this. A lot of talk around Tony and Muembo as well. Josh De Silva, I think, was absolutely brilliant. And for me, probably maybe even man of the match. You know, he'd done so well in that midfield role for Brentford. And the reason why I say that is because also it's been well documented that he very nearly didn't, you know, very nearly didn't play again. But his form, you know, he's got himself back fit and fighting, and he's a decent young player and a decent young prospect. And he was really, really good for Brentford. And I like the look of him. And generally speaking, across the board, that, you know, they seem to have signed well again. And I don't think, you know, really, I know a couple of people have muted them from relegation before the season started, but certainly after that result and their early season form, 4 points from the first two, scoring 6 goals, albeit 4 of them in the game, just going into I don't even know how you define that Man United team now, but, you know, it's one of them. I think they'll be safe as houses. It was a great performance. And as for Manchester United, I think we all watch in bated breath for the next 2 weeks to, if I'm honest, mostly revel in the delight of their struggles, because I think from their perspective, that's exactly what it's going to become. Come the end of the transfer window as well. And then you've got a question where they go from there. How long does, you know, Ten Hag get? What I will say about Ten Hag is he came with a lot of hype based on his results with Ajax and what he did in the Champions League with them, which, you know, was fantastic. But I can't help but feel that he's been left hung out to dry. And this feels like to me, and, you know, the lads will say, oh, here we go, trying to shoe in Palace here. But genuinely, genuinely, from outside looking in, this is seemingly a Frank de Boer V2 situation, as it was at Palace. De Boer came in at Palace, was linked with a load of, surprise, surprise, Dutch players. We did get a couple of those in for him, namely Jairo Ridderwold from Ajax at the time. He came in and wanted to revolutionise the whole style of play. We didn't back him to the gill. And, you know, he was gone after, what was it, 3 or 4 games and never got going. You know, at Man United, you've already got, the leak came out after the Brentford game about him questioning his tactics and making the players sprint as much as Brentford did, the difference in terms of what they did or didn't do in the game. And he got criticised from the kind of scientific sports world for increasing the load on the players at a time where they're more susceptible potentially to injuries. But it just seems like to me the daggers are out a little bit early on him in terms of his methods. That in turn is going to give ammunition to players to start questioning his methods and his methodology behind stuff, which is, you know, once that starts happening, you're on a hide into nothing. And so the circle continues. And I think that's what it will be for Man United. I can't see anything different than that. Moving on to Sunday's televised game, so we'll come back to the rest of Saturday's action, but this first part of the pod will just focus on the televised games. Big coup for Forest in the earlier Sunday game. So Nottingham Forest, West Ham ended 1-0. Cracking game of football, it has to be said. That felt like, you know, a real, not to sound like Graeme Souness here, but it was a corker of a game. It had it all. And, you know, it has to be said, West Ham will be licking their wounds a little bit in terms of not taking their chances, namely the Declan Rice penalty, which was a definite penalty. I don't think people were calling for a red card, but I could be wrong, but I seem to think if you were given a penalty, it was either a sending off and no penalty, or a penalty and no sending off. I can't remember now, but I think, to be fair, the referee handled it in the right way. Forest, I think, looked really, really good. As I say, they had the benefit of home advantage as well. Great result for them as well. Dean Henderson, I criticised him last week, saying, it was quite bold of him to do what he did, speak out against Man United, then probably didn't have the best game against Newcastle, but he made amends for that and made sure he came out on top in the game against West Ham this week because, penalty save, yes. But generally speaking, I thought we had a pretty solid game for Nottingham Forest as well. They started off on the front foot, and I think the home crowd gave them that extra impetus just to get over the line. They've got a lot of signings that have come in. Emmanuel Dennis, Kiarte is now coming on a free, talk of more signings. Which, they, in fairness, jokes aside, they do need to do that because they lost 12 or 13 players as well. So, it's to me, it's not a surprise. But they started off at a massively, massively fast-paced, kind of almost frantic start, and it was brilliant to see. As for West Ham, probably a bit of sour taste in the mouth that they didn't score the penalty. And Declan Rice obviously now takes over for Mark Noble. So Benrahma hit the bar as well. And Souček also close, but I think it was Toffolo. He made a massive clearance off the line as well. Scamacca also didn't really have the desired impact after coming on from Antonio. Obviously, he's new in from Serie A, so it'll probably take him a few games just to get up and running. But as for West Ham, I mean, we laughed at Cossi to say they'd finish, 13th in predictions. Two games gone and 0 points. If they're going to get in and around the sixth or seventh, that we certainly said that they would, they're going to need to start finding their form pretty sharpish, because that's now two games. It's only two games. We say two games, but, it is only two games in. But for a club with such high expectations, Europa Conference League games, I believe, start tomorrow as well. So, as I say, first game of the season is Man City. This game was always going to be tough on paper for them. But, the next three are, they've got Brighton at home, and Brighton aren't going to be easy. They've then got Villa away, and then they've got Tottenham at home as well. So, and if you look at the next six league games, you've got Brighton, Villa, Tottenham, Chelsea, Newcastle and Everton. So I'm sure results will come for West Ham, because they do like, especially the Chelsea and Tottenham games, they do like a London derby. But you look at that Brighton game, and if they don't make it, and it could be, early doors looking over their shoulder a little bit. Not that I think they'll go down, but certainly for the expectation of the club this season, it could be quite tricky. For them. As for Forest, they'll be relieved to get that first win at home, out the way and done with. It's a big few months ahead for them, because they've got a lot of new signings to integrate, and the longer they went without a win, that would have added to the pressure. But they've got the 3 points, which at this stage is all that matters, I think, for them. Eases the pressure going into this week in training, and they'll go again as well. So I'm sure they'll be pleased with that. And then we head over to what was, for me, probably, aside from the Brentford 45 minutes, probably the game of the weekend. And that was Chelsea-Tottenham. And it really did live up to the hype as, battle at the bridge. It had everything. It was complete Premier League, blockbuster, pantomime, just pure, pure kind of Premier League peak football. Where do you start? I mean, well, Tottenham, to be fair, didn't really turn up for the first kind of 45 minutes. And Chelsea, you looked at Tottenham and thought, be licking their wounds a little bit here. Obviously, Koulibaly, I mean, the new signings really is story of the game, really, because Cucurella took, obviously, I think it was the corner that came in, and Koulibaly scored an absolute blinder. For a centre-back, what a finish, by the way. And Sterling had a hand in the, you know, James's goal as well in the build-up to that. So it was really, obviously, the dramatic game, but Chelsea absolutely dominated the first half. Spurs didn't really get going, didn't really kind of push themselves into the game or lay a glove on them, to be honest, and didn't really get going until the second half when, you know, they equalised in the 68th minute. And then that's when, I mean, you could say the game really came to light as well. I mean, there was a few decisions, you know, a lot of talk about the referee and Anthony Taylor at the end of the game, and how Spurs got away with a few different things. Look, the Cucurella one, the challenge on Kai Havertz, well, let's start off with the challenge on Kai Havertz. I thought that was... blew out of proportion a bit for kind of 50-50, you know, that happens. Kai Havertz, for me, is a kind of melodramatic and gets caught sometimes anyway. So I guess that's the, you know, you leave yourself open to that when the referees have to analyse those decisions. Much has been said about similar players like Zaha and stuff before. So it's one of them. The more obvious one and the biggest talking one was obviously towards the end of the game, and that was involving Cucurella and Romero and the hair pull. I mean, in all fairness, jokes aside, how that was missed and how that wasn't picked up on, God only knows. And it goes back to, you know, is it VAR, is it the referees, or is it the, you know, the people handling VAR that are fit for purpose? I don't really know what you can say to that, but what I will say is it made a great game. And, you know, not only that, Conte and Tuchel at the end. I mean, you couldn't make it up. Kane, obviously, with the dramatic equaliser added to it. But it was great competition. And for, you know, Tuchel to kind of have a bit of a joke about it at the end, saying that, you know, they're fighting for their teams and stuff, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Conte is obviously a serial winner. I think he acknowledged that they're kind of playing catch up a little bit with their rivals and stuff. And I think, you know, a lot of people will say, and some people have said this, because I think Bissouma, Palace fan, you know, Brighton love to celebrate a draw, but he came in for a lot of criticism for, you know, celebrating as he did for the draw and how Spurs celebrated. But I think it further demonstrated the winner mentality that, you know, Spurs have got at the club now and the competition have got at the club. Also, though, not to forget that, you know, if you're in a title race and you're going for the title, early doors, your games against your title rivals, so for Tottenham, that would be Chelsea, that would be Man City, Liverpool and Arsenal. Your first rule would be, do not lose. Whatever we do, do not lose. And they haven't lost. At the end of the day, Chelsea have, you know, a title rival or potential top four slash title rival has dropped 2 points. And Tottenham, yes, have dropped 2 points. But, you know, it's not really dropped. It just means that it keeps them on par. So, and for Spurs, given that they overachieved last season, managed to get fourth in the end, that's an absolutely massive result. They sit there with, you know, 2 games played, 4 points, you know, one of which was Chelsea, which is at the bridge, which historically for them has not been a happy hunting ground. So I think they will be pretty, pretty happy with that, given that they've had a home game against Southampton, now an away game at Chelsea, which, you know, for them is great. They've now got a home game against Wolves, their next three, home to Wolves, away to Forest and away to West Ham. So 4 points from those two. Get the 3 points against Wolves. Forest obviously be a tough test, but you'd expect them to come out. And I think after that West Ham game, so what would be then 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, kind of 5 or 6 games in, that's when we'll really know. If you look further to that, in fact, it's kind of 7 and 8 with Fulham at home and then Man City away. So come middle of September, we'll really know what Spurs are about. So in context of that, look, it's a massive result. Massive, massive result. Obviously, there's still time in the transfer window as well. But clearly, you know, they're on the upward trajectory. And, you know, Kane gets a goal in amongst the goals as well. So I can't say fairer than that. I don't think I think before the game, Tottenham, to be fair, would have taken a point regardless. So no complaints from me there at all whatsoever from that perspective. I think they've got every right to celebrate, you know, how they did. But again, as I say, definitely game of the weekend, absolutely brilliant. And I'd have my money, you know, on Conte to finish Tuchel if I was a better man, to be honest. That just added to it. But, you know, what a great game. It was, you know, it was brilliant, brilliant to watch. And that's that. Moving on now, we touched on a few of the teams here. So we'll go to, we'll go to Man City. Comfortable 4-0 win against Bournemouth, unsurprisingly. But Haaland, I mean, he upset me in the Fantasy League, and also I've bet with a few bet builders as well, because, you know, no goal for Haaland. Only two passes made as well. He did get an assist, in all fairness. But, yeah, very muted performance from him. But look, when you're a team like City, four different goal scorers, albeit one being a known goal, it was always going to be a comfortable win for them. Bournemouth, no surprises. You know, they got an opening win last week, so they'll take that every day of the week. And I don't think, you know, even Scott Parker had said that, you know, they wouldn't have had anything here anyway. So, you know, what happened. Biggest talking point for me for that game was seeing Scott Parker dressed up in a fleece, by the way, on the day where there was an amber warning out for a heat wave. So not quite sure what that was about, but, you know, kudos to him. He, you know, carries himself in a certain way and, you know, maintains it. So fair enough. Then we go to Arsenal. Now, for me, on paper, probably a little bit of a test for them. Leicester, although we have said, you know, Leicester are a bit up and down. Jesus again, I mean, wow. You know, he looks like he is really thriving in that number one, being that number one option, being that striker that wants to play every single week and being the vocal point. Two goals, two assists, and his compatriot Martinelli obviously on the score sheet as well. Xhaka, fairly influential as well. Absolutely brilliant. Looked a little bit leaky and dangerous again when challenged at the back. We keep saying it, and Scott said it last week, I think, and then, you know, the transfer update pod a couple of weeks ago, we both discussed it. With Arsenal, it seems like they've always got decent attacking options available, but when it comes to the midfield and the back line, that's where they're kind of missing. Saliba own goal, who would have thought it? Sod's Law put him back in the fantasy team and that happens. But look, the mistakes they made at the back line, I think that will improve over time. The, you know, the young squad, I think that will get them, that will be enough for them. The key for Arsenal, I think, will be, in the absence of no midfielders coming in, is keeping Gabriel Jesus fit, because he looks like, he arguably is one of the signings, along with Haaland, given the cost of those in transfer fees on paper versus the position and the premium they normally command for that position. Great piece of business for the club. And as I say, big result for them in context of, on paper, Leicester is someone that would normally challenge them. And you'd never know what you were going to get. On the flip side with Leicester, surprised me a little bit. They did play well. James Maddison again looked influential. So given all the transfer speculation with him, I thought he had a very, very good game. They still have these massive rumours circling with Wesley Fofana and James Maddison. And obviously also Youri Tielemans has been spoken about. So there's kind of three key players. I don't believe for a second all three will go. But clearly, you know, they need signings. Or they need reinforcements, or they need, you know, they need to stay, you know, kind of stabilise a little bit with the players that are kind of murmuring France as well. Interesting that Rodgers said there was no plan for new signings, which I would hazard being a slight problem, if I'm honest, because they do clearly need reinforcements. But it doesn't seem like they're coming anytime soon. They, you know, clearly, maybe they're confident in keeping Maddison and Tielemans now. And obviously, if they get the money for Farmer, then maybe that gives them an opportunity to reinvest late in the window. But that won't be easy, because if they get the money that they're demanding for Fofana and it's a world record for a defender or even close to that, then, you know, it sets the price tag for any conversations they have at that end part of the window as well. So interesting times at Leicester, but they didn't look as bad. Mind you, I say they didn't look as bad as what I thought they would be. They still conceded four goals, so it kind of eliminates the point a little bit. But, you know, on balance for Arsenal, job done. And if they can really get the momentum going now, then they could be looking really, really good. Brighton, Newcastle. Story of Brighton, really, over the last couple of seasons. They had some decent, decent chances. Pascal Gross, namely, at the end as well. Brighton with a better team on the day as well, which I don't think is a concern for Newcastle. I think a point away from home against someone like Brighton is probably a decent result. They were under the cosh a bit, though. But again, story of Brighton over the last couple of years. Conversion chances, say that Pascal Gross chance. After his form at Old Trafford last week, you'd have probably backed him to put that away. But to no avail, but 0-0. And if that game was halfway through the season, you'd probably say the two teams would probably be fairly close together in the table. So probably about right for both of them as well. Southampton Leeds. Wow. What a game. I mean, I had Southampton down to potentially get this. Scott has been a big advocate of Leeds and their signings and has been impressed. And to be fair, for an hour, or just over an hour, Leeds lived up to that potential. Rodrigo, I had not a pop at, but I was concerned about his form from last season and would he pick it up. He's already got two goals now this season. I think he only got five or six last season, so he's seemingly coming out of the traps. But they did come unstuck, and Southampton got it back through new signing Aribo and then Walker Peters with a brilliant finish as well. And I must say, from a Southampton perspective, now they've really gambled with how they've, you know, how they've gone about their business in terms of going for the kind of best of youth. They really have gambled on that, which may or may not hinder them. But what I will say is Mara, who they signed from, I think it was Bordeaux, looked absolutely brilliant when he came on. And that assist for Walker Peters was unbelievable. And I do think that he is one to watch out for over the next season or so. Because I think if he has a good season here, he could be one where a few of the bigger clubs will sniff pretty quickly around him. And you know, they'll have trouble keeping hold of him. Interesting as well, this game, because a lot of the build-up was dominated by leaks in the media that Hassan Hüttl had lost members of the dressing room and that they didn't really, you know, believe in his methods. Look, for them to come from 2-0 down against a seemingly decent Leeds team at the start of this season would suggest to me that, you know, I know they're professionals and they play for their own pride, but it would suggest that maybe it's not as bad as what some would suggest. But clearly, I mean, we've spoken about Southampton a lot in terms of their ability and inconsistency to go on a winning streak and then just fall off a cliff and concede goals. But there's no doubt about it. They've got some good, young, exciting players. So if Hassan Hüttl can get that right, you know, they should be okay. But again, at the end of the day, it's two games gone, 1 point from two. One of them was away to Spurs. And the first home game, 2-0 down, not great, but they did, you know, he won it back round again. So still early days, but never good at this early stage when your manager is the talking point. And as for Leeds, you know, they'll be happy. You know, fifth, 4 points from two. I think if you'd given them that at the beginning of the season, they would have absolutely bitten your hand off for that. You know, and obviously they beat Wolves as well. So they've had a good start, you know, one home game, one away game. They've had a good, solid start from their perspective against teams that they would want to take points off as well, not just random results, but they're teams that you'd expect to be kind of bottom half, mid-table, and, you know, rule number one is to at least get a point, you know, respect the point against those. But to get 4 points from those two games, you know, that's brilliant on their part. And I think the manager, I'd criticise him a lot as well. I thought he'd be the first one on the chopping block, but fair play to him. He's come in and, you know, solid start. It's just whether or not they can build up a consistency. We go on to Wolves and Fulham. Mitrovic, talking point, missed a penalty. Shame for Fulham, because to get that point against Liverpool, first game of the season, solid start. And this game, had he put that away, then it would have been 4 points from two. And given all the upheaval that Fulham and Marco Silva has seemingly put up with in terms of lack of transfer activity and lack of defenders, you know, that would have been a respectable start to the season and certainly would have allowed Silva to eliminate the pressure from players and they could enjoy it a bit more. And we know what comes with that. If you're enjoying it and you're playing well, then it breeds confidence as well. Wolves, though, story of their season, missed chances again. New signing Guedes was on the bench. They've obviously just made a record-breaking bid for a Sporting attacking midfielder from Lisbon, which caught me by surprise a little bit, but it'll be interesting to see how that kind of links up with the rest of the team and the strategy for the rest of the transfer market. But they haven't bought in a lot. But, you know, Podence and Neto and Huangwu, you know, look decent. But I think the key for Wolves is going to be, is can you put the ball in the net? Can you? And last season, they were creating chances and they were drawing too many games. Now, if Mitrovic puts that penalty away, they don't draw the game, they come away with no points. So Wolves really need to find their shooting boots. I'll be interested to see what happens with, you know, their backline now that Connor Cody's gone. That was a bit of an odd one for me. But, you know, they're going to have to find some sparkle from somewhere. And they, you know, they do need to, I think Larg have kind of alluded to it post-match. They need to kind of grow and evolve as a team, and that's important because there's no doubt they've got a few players in there that can make the difference. And they seem to be, I'm not saying he hasn't lost the dressing room, but we know in the Premier League, if you don't take your chances, if you can't score the goals and put the ball in the net, then it becomes an issue. No coincidence that I have left this one until last. Because, of course, it was the most recent one in everyone's mind, and that is the Monday night kickoff, and that was Liverpool versus Crystal Palace. Now, Liverpool go into that game, obviously, with City top on 6 points, Arsenal top on 6 points, Spurs on 4 points, having played Chelsea on 4 points. So, over to Liverpool, and a great opportunity for Liverpool off the back of that surprising result against Fulham to really lay down a bit of a marker and kind of say, no, that was just a blip. But it wasn't. And much to everyone's surprise, including mine, they just couldn't get it in the net. And look, let's not kid ourselves here, especially in that first half. It was a real backs-to-the-wall job for Palace. Vieira opted for a back three, which always scares me a little bit, you know, when you try a different formation against a bigger team that is far inferior in quality. But we did it, and it was backs to the wall at times, and we rode our luck massively, which you need in these kind of games against these teams. But Palace did ride their luck. They were patient, and, you know, they were waiting for the counter-attack. And the sting in the tail came on, I think it was the 41st minute, and it has to be said, what a goal. And I know it was a good goal because even Scott, who's still not convinced and quite harsh on his A, given that he's been out for the best part of 17 months and come back from a interior ligament injury, quite a big injury by all accounts. But for him to actually say, wow, what a goal, says it all. Wilfred Zaha. Now, one thing I think Scott did say in that one, which was interesting, was, and that's why he's not considered a top player, which is always an interesting debate. But I think people often forget that, you know, last season he got 14 league goals. The only players as wingers that outscored him on that kind of level was Mane and Son of Spurs. So I think Zaha is at that level, but seemingly, for me, the reason why he hasn't got his move to a big club isn't because of his, you know, this brazen attitude he seems to apparently have, which is what a lot of fans run with. A simple fact is, I just think it always has been a valuation thing. Palace have seemingly cleverly, whichever way you look at it, have priced him out of the market because they've put him on 130K a week, which was a 5-year contract. He's now in the last year of that. But to pay someone from a club like Palace that kind of money to come into a top four team or top six team takes a lot of doing. And yeah, he hasn't shown it always as consistent as he should. But I think last season, the last couple of seasons, certainly, he's proved time and time again that he is the go-to man. And I think you put him in a Chelsea, you put him in a Tottenham, you put him in a Manchester United, ironically, you put him in a City, you put him in an Arsenal team, and I think he scores 14 or 15 goals each season, no problem at all. That goal, make no mistake about it, that finish, and I'm not going to, because it'll come across as biased, and you'll all just say I'm being biased here, but that finish was absolutely unbelievable. The run, the way he arched his back and lined up his run, the finish, the composure to do that at the angle he did, at the distance he did against a goalkeeper like Alisson in that moment was absolutely brilliant. On the flip side, yes, he did miss a couple of sitters and his decision making. Had that been better, Palace could have come away with 3 points, let's be honest, especially when Liverpool went down to 10 men. But look, on balance for me, I'd say Liverpool had the first half, Palace had the second half. Ironically, when the red card came, the game flipped on its head a little bit and it almost kind of had the reverse effect, which is a bit of a joke amongst Palace fans that we never beat anyone with 10 men. But it did flip on its head. And to be honest, it was the only time that infamous, or I say that in inverted commas, the infamous Anfield atmosphere kind of came to fruition was those last kind of 15 minutes when they were trying to drive forward. So, you know, amazing result for Palace, brilliant result. And I think, you know, kudos to, I mean, for me, Zaha aside, I think Eze played well. Anderson, again, we said it in the Arsenal game how he performed. He put in another top-notch performance as well. And I haven't just lined this up already to discuss the big talking point, but Nunez in that game, I mean, he made a fluff of a chance just before half time, which I think would have flipped the game on its head. But he's really got some steep, steep learning to do if all it takes is another player giving him a little shove in the back because he was caught. And I think a lot of people have misrealised this. A lot of Liverpool fans are coming out and saying, well, Anderson started it. Well, no, he got shoved in the shoulder and Anderson was drawing attention to the referee because actually, he had an initial attempt at headbutting Anderson before he followed through with the second one. And that's what, you know, kind of started that instigated the whole thing. So, from that score, Nunez has got a lot of learning to do because he's going to come up against that every single week. And that aside, you might be frustrated as a striker that things aren't going your way, and you might take issue at the player for giving you a little shove on the back. But, you know, we're not just talking about a headbutt here. That was a full-on assault headbutt. Like, if me and you done that in the streets, yeah, I'd be arrested for GBH. It was, you know, okay, it was a bit comical how Anderson went down. But I generally think, you know, one, he was shocked at how the headbutt connected. And two, it was right in his face slash the top of his kind of lip and jaw area. So fair play to Klopp for coming out and kind of, you know, talking out on it, saying, you know, not justifying it and not just brushing it under the carpet. But I mean, come on, Liverpool fans that sit there and try and justify it, it's an absolute joke. Klopp post-match again entertained me. So what was it? We had the pitch was too dry at Fulham, so we had a witch in the building this week. So I very much look forward to what Klopp has to say next week should things not go their way against Man United. I mean, let's face it, if things don't go their way against Ten Hag and United, then maybe there was a witch in the building, there is a curse. But look, jokes aside for Liverpool, pressure I would say is on now because 2 games gone against Fulham and Crystal Palace. And on paper, for Liverpool Football Club, title challenger, that should be 6 points. And they've come away with two draws and only three goals. And they've conceded three goals as well. So tricky for Klopp going into that Man United game. Because look, Man United are a basket case at the moment. But if Liverpool come away with another draw there, and I don't think they will for a second, I do think that will be the game everything clicks. And I do think potentially United will get their backsides handed to them again. But three games in after that, I mean, those three fixtures, regardless of Man United, no disrespect to United, but because of where they've been the last couple of years, I would back Liverpool would have had on paper at least 7 points out of the first three games. And they've come away with, well, at the moment, after two games, two. So depending on what happens next week, they could be 4 points, they could be 5 points, or they could be 2 points behind that trajectory. So it's quite a crucial game for Liverpool, I'd say, because look, anything less than 3 points there, if City, Arsenal and Spurs and Chelsea go on to do a job again, it seems daft to say this after three games, but that's potentially them out of the title race. And I think Carragher and, yeah, I think it was Carragher alluded to on Monday Night Football. Back in the day, pre-Man City and the billionaires of this football world coming together to buy football clubs, you might have got away with that slow start because you know you could claw it back. But City are like machines. Arsenal look like a well-oiled machine. Not that I think they'll be up there for the title, but again, psychologically for Arsenal, if they get a win next week and Liverpool drop, you know, it all kind of contributes. Tottenham, I think, will be up there. I've said will be up there this season with Conte. Chelsea, busy playing football manager, much to Cookie's delight, but I think they probably would fancy themselves to be up there. So Liverpool have a bit of work to do, and I think the pressure will be on a little bit. And we did say that weak points for them, midfield, further showed again, I think, because they didn't necessarily control it as much as they wanted, although I must say that Harvey Elliott had a decent game for them. So all's not lost there, but clearly they're struggling with a bit of depth that they just need. It's three games now without Nunes as well. So it just adds to the pressure. You know, Salah can't afford to get knocked now. So Liverpool, I don't believe they're going to do anything in the transfer market. So I don't think it's a big couple of weeks for them in that respect. But certainly they need to focus on getting back to winning ways or pretty fast. Because if not, you know, after the United game, in fairness, they've got Bournemouth and Newcastle respectively at Anfield. So that you would back them to get 6 points from there. But it all has already created quite a sizable gap. So they do need to start looking at that. And, you know, hopefully whichever witch is present at the training ground disappears, because otherwise Klopp's going to have to find something else to blame, or someone else to blame for their downfall. So full of drama. So two games in here. So no surprises at the top. A lot of people have them on top. We've got Man City. Bottom three as it stands at the moment, Everton, West Ham, Manchester United. Don't believe for a second that'll be the bottom three in like five games' time. But I'm sure Kossi will be happy at the fact West Ham are down there, because it further justifies his seemingly crazy prediction that they could finish, I think it was 13th, for the coming season. And at the moment, he's not far wrong. Talking of not far wrong, just to wrap up, we will, and I will just quickly run over the lads and their, obviously, as you know, if you listened last week, we've got the fantasy team, fantasy league that we do. It's been a bad week for me again. Cookie stormed ahead and stole top place with 82 points this week. No surprises that he was very, I mean, look, let's face it, he got, you know, he had Jesus, he had Haaland, you know, De Bruyne and Diaz. He's done pretty well, to be fair. And Trippier and Diaz, I mean, I don't know how he's managed that. Fluky as ever. Kossi is quite literally top of the flops. He is in third. I somehow managed to be bottom, and Scott has managed to bring his way a little bit back up. Cookie, you'll be happy. And ironically, with Cookie, he seems to do a disappearing act when things go well. So I'm surprised he wasn't on here tonight to give his Arsenal spiel. But That about wraps us. Cossie will breathe a sigh of relief. Norrie's finally got off his third or fourth team, is it, that he supports. Finally got off to a winning start in the Championship at home last week. And that about wraps that. So game week two is done. Next week should hopefully be a little bit more lively. You'll have myself, maybe Scott, depending on the baby situation. But I believe Cookie should be back. But thanks for joining this week. That is game week two wrapped. And we will catch you next week. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Total Football Debate podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. It would mean the world to us if you could spread the word regarding our show and leave us a rating so we know how we're doing. Also, please, please, please interact with us on social media, especially on Twitter at TF Debate, where we'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on any of the topics we discuss each week. You never know, we may even get you on the show to say hello. Thanks again for listening and keep an ear out for the next episode.